Welcome inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. Protests against police killing unarmed Black Americans continue across the country, including here in Appalachia.
I'm out here marching for the future. I want to make sure that my kids don't turn into George Floyd.
Protesters are asking for an end to police brutality. Many also point to our nation's long history with systemic racism. One example is the Black diaspora. For generations, many Black Appalachians have left the region in search of work.
This has been a story of African American struggle and striving that we can trace through American history because we're always getting kicked out or moved from where we settle down.
Economic pressures linked to systemic racism have existed for hundreds of years and continue today. You'll find these stories and more this week inside Appalachia. Welcome inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. Tens of thousands of people have taken to the streets. Young people, old people, Black and white. They're protesting the deaths of George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, and here in Appalachia, victims such as Robert Ellis, who we'll learn more about later in the show. These and other Black people continue to face intimidation, racism, and inequality. In both rural and urban areas of Appalachia, people have rallied these past few weeks demanding racial equality. Next week, June 19th, also marks Juneteenth, also known as Freedom Day, which commemorates the end of slavery in the United States 155 years ago. Also worth mentioning is that June 12th is also known as Loving Day, referring to the case of Mildred and Richard Loving, a Black woman and white man who married, defying state law in Virginia which banned interracial marriages. In 1967, the couple in Virginia fought their case all the way to the Supreme Court and won. Loving Day has been viewed as one of the landmark civil rights victories of the 60s. We're going to start off our show today with the voice of a young person of color, talking about their vision for a better and more just Appalachia. Here's 17-year-old Aiden Satterfield of Charleston, West Virginia.
Being a person of color in West Virginia for sure is tough. Charleston, Huntington, Beckley, all those, I guess you could say, bigger towns in West Virginia, I feel like racism isn't as big, but in the rural areas, it's a real issue. It's a real problem. There are pluses to being an African-American or a person of color in West Virginia, I'd say, from a personal standpoint. One being is that when you do see other people of color and when you're around other people of color, you really feel a sense of being united and being around each other, and you feel like you should be there and you feel like you become as one. Also, one of my visions that I'd like to see would be, if it's possible, the rural areas in West Virginia to be exposed to different cultures and different people, because you can't blame them if they've never ever seen a person of color, because that's a real issue. Maybe if those rural schools, elementary schools, took a trip to Charleston and went to the Clay Center and saw other schools around here, maybe that's something that they could do, or that starts them young and then they do say, oh, there's actually other people, like, there's other people in the world. I know they see stuff on TV, but if they could actually witness it with their own eyes, I think that would help West Virginia a lot.
Aiden, thank you for sharing your message and perspective with us. We'd love to hear from more young people across Appalachia. What is your vision for a better future, a more fair Appalachia? An Appalachia that would help keep you here and help you thrive. Record your message using a voice memo app on your phone and email it to insideappalachia@wvpublic.org. If you live in Appalachia, you've probably noticed that portrayals of our region don't always depict the real picture of life here or our people. Although Appalachia is not as diverse as the nation as a whole, nearly 10% of the people here are Black. Still, those voices are often overlooked in many news reports about our region. There are many people here in Appalachia who are working to change the narrative. Frank X. Walker is one. He's a poet who lives in Kentucky, and in 1991, he came up with the word Afrolatcha. He and a group of 36 poets, writers, and artists across our region call themselves the Afrolatchan Poets.
To us, it was about making the invisible visible, or giving voice to a previously muted or silenced voice.
That's Walker back in 2016. He gave the keynote speech at the Appalachian Studies Association Conference, which was hosted that year at Shepherd University.
My first year at the Kentucky Book Festival, a white man walked up to my booth and announced that he'd been looking at his map all day and didn't see no Appalachia nowhere. I smiled, considered my many optional responses, and asked him if he'd been using a black and white map or a full color map. When he responded with, "Black and white, I reckon," I said, "Well, that's the problem. You need a colored map to see Appalachia."
Of course, Appalachia can't be found on an actual map. Walker says that during the recent protests and during the pandemic, he and many of the Appalachian writers have been writing about what's happening in real time. Walker has been posting a poem a day on his Facebook page since April 1st. We'll hear from another Appalachian poet later in our show. First, we're going to explore some of our region's history with systemic racism. Race riots here during the 60s may not have been as extreme as they were elsewhere in the country. Throughout our history, many black and white people have joined forces to rise up together to demand better conditions for working class. But racism exists here. Many different types of racism, sadly. It's an ugly truth that gives me shame whenever I hear someone quoted from Appalachia who says a racist remark. I'd love to believe that Appalachians embrace our history of racial solidarity, but not all of us do. Last weekend, a protest in Charleston calling for an end to police brutality against black people was postponed due to safety concerns. According to organizers, threats were made against the event, which was expected to attract thousands. A small crowd still gathered at the Capitol grounds Sunday for a peaceful protest. Another event on Charleston's west side went ahead as planned. About 100 people gathered in front of Dem Two Brothers Barbecue restaurant on Sunday. The West Side protest is part of an ongoing demonstration that's taken place several times in the past few weeks. 19-year-old Kaylin Wills is one of the organizers.
Well, honestly, I've always been really passionate about Black Lives Matter. When I feel like I was probably 12 or around there when Trayvon Martin died, but I was so young, I couldn't ever do anything. I couldn't ever be heard.
Will says the protests she's helped organize have continued to gain momentum each day. She says threats against protesters are concerning, but they haven't stopped people from gathering.
But ever since the second day when a lot of people started coming out, we had threats every single day. People said, "Oh, we're going to hit you with our car. Oh, if we see you, we're going to shoot you." Like, same things like that.
The mood of the protest on Charleston's west side was celebratory. Music played and some families with small children participated. A continuous stream of people in cars honked as they drove by to show their support of racial equality. Protesters also gathered in Bluefield, Mercer County last weekend, joining hundreds of thousands worldwide who are rallying to oppose police brutality against black people. Protesters say they marched to remember recent black deaths, but also for a local black man, Robert Ellison, who was paralyzed after an encounter with police in the late 90s. I went to this protest, along with West Virginia Public Broadcasting's Emily Allen.
In 1998, police dragged and beat a black man in Bluefield, paralyzing him below the neck for 5 years before he ultimately died in 2002. That man was Robert Ellison. More than 20 years later, a crowd of 150 or so protesters wore Ellison's name on the back of their shirts. They shouted his name, calling on his memory, along with that of George Floyd and Breonna Taylor. A black man and a black woman who have died within the last couple of months at the hands of police in other states.
We're not powerless people, even though events like this make us feel like it.
This is Shakira Irvin, who lives in Bluefield. She helped organize the protest on Saturday.
When we come together, we realize we're not just coming together in anger, not just in disappointment, but we're coming together in power.
We have it in our power right now to change policy. We have it in our power right now to hold people accountable.
After Ellison's encounter with police, the city created a Citizens Review Board for Police Matters. The board in Bluefield is one of only a few in the state today. Randolph Phillips, who was at Saturday's rally, is on that board.
It works fairly well as far as keeping them accountable to what happens.
Phillips was appointed a few years ago after retiring from the Virginia Department of Corrections. He says the board considers about 4 to 5 reported cases a year.
I think the major thing that any city, any area needs to do is to hold the police accountable for what they do. Because they're the example that the public sees every day. They should live up to those standards of who they are. And we should hold them accountable for who they are.
Even though there has been some steps in the right direction, protest organizer Irvin says there are still some shortfalls. She wishes the board had more teeth. Right now, they're only an advisory group. They can request action, but they can't enforce it. That, and Irvin says, not everyone in Bluefield is aware of the board.
I don't think all the citizens who need to know about that know about it. I don't think they know how to make that mechanism work for them. So we want to educate on that.
Saturday's event was about more than Ellison, recent deaths, and police. After marching half a mile from the Mount Zion Baptist Church to the former Big Whiskey Barbecue restaurant downtown, speakers addressed the crowd about voting and the census.
Also, please make sure that you are counted in the census.
This is April Burroughs, another organizer.
Without the census, without being counted, we will not have funding brought to our area.
Burroughs lives in Huntington now, but grew up in the Bluefield area. She was a junior in high school when police hurt Ellison.
It was an awful, awful, awful situation, and it was police brutality at that point.
Burroughs was at a protest in Huntington last weekend.
I went home and I realized that I needed to come home to do something. I realized that maybe some of the light needed to be brought to where I'm from to bring a sense of unity to the community that I grew up in.
Many of the people who gathered Saturday traveled home from elsewhere. That includes Kashayla Collins, a Black woman who grew up in Bluefield.
I'm out here marching for the future. I want to make sure that my kids don't turn into George Floyd.
She and her two young sons, Kayvon and Khalil, traveled from Augusta, Georgia. Collins says she's been marching there, but the rally in Bluefield was a first for her two boys.
But it's the children right now that we have to represent for. And so I want them to look at me and be like, my mommy stood up for something. And it's important that they see us standing up for them, because at 5 and 8 year old, they don't have the voice or even the mental capacity to always understand the injustice that's occurring. But I want them to know when they get older, they'll remember.
A few blocks from the rally, a Black father stands outside, also wanting a better future for his kids and the kids in his community. He did not attend the protest.
My name's Kevin Ross. I'm a detective at Bluefield Police Department.
Ross also grew up in the area in McDowell County. Like protesters, he agrees there's a need for change, which is why he says he joined the police department.
You sit around here and you listen to people talk about the police this, the police that, and, oh, I wish this would change, I wish that would stop, but you don't see them putting applications in nowhere. I mean, that was my reason for doing it.
While Ross did not participate in the protest, he says he was within earshot.
I listened to a lot of it as it was going on, and there were some good points. Hopefully things will change. But at the same time, we have to come together for it to change.
There is power in the name of Jesus. There is power in the name of Jesus.
For Inside Appalachia, I'm Emily Allen in Bluefield.
In the name of Jesus. To break every chain.
Back in the early 1900s, the coalfields of our region were once multicultural hubs filled with immigrants from other countries like Italy and Greece. And many African Americans from the Deep South also came to work in the mines and later the steel mills. But the decline in the coal industry led many African Americans to leave Appalachia in search of work. They went to cities like Detroit and Chicago. Of course, it wasn't just African Americans who left. White folks left too. But layoffs often hit people from the African American communities the hardest. If any of this sounds familiar, you may recall that we aired a story from Lynch, Kentucky a few years ago as part of our series, The Struggle to Stay. Derek Akal is one of the young people we followed for a year as they wrestled with the decision of whether to stay in Appalachia or leave in pursuit of work or school. Considering the news of the past few weeks, we thought this would be a good time to listen back to part of Derek's story. Here's a quick recap. Derek got a college football scholarship, and he thought that was going to be his ticket out, but a serious neck injury led him to dropping out of school and coming back home. We pick up the story back in Harlan County, where at the time, Derek was living with his mom and his grandma. Reporter Benny Becker followed Derek and his family for about a year and recorded their story. And a quick heads up, you'll hear a racial slur a few times in the story.
Generation after generation, people in Derek's family have felt pressure to move away from home. The struggle to stay is a central part of Derek's family history and the history of his hometown, a little place called Lynch.
How do you feel about the name of this town?
You know, it don't bother me much. You know, I just wish it was named different because, you know, Lynch and you got lynchings and stuff like that.
Lynch was actually named after Thomas Lynch. He was an executive at U.S. Steel, the company that built this coal camp town back in 1917. Today, there are yard signs posted all around Lynch to let everyone know that the town is celebrating 100 years of existence, here at the foot of Kentucky's highest peak, which happens to be named Black Mountain.
Black Mountain, living Lynch, in a black community, you know. what can you say to it, you know?
I asked Derek if he knew much about his family's history and how they'd come to live in Lynch.
My grandma and my mom down here, they really don't say much about it. Karita knows more about it. She probably talks about it the most.
Derek's talking about his cousin, Karita Brown.
Hello, my name is Karita Brown. I am a visiting assistant professor at UNC Chapel Hill. I'm also full-time faculty in the Department of Sociology at University of California at Los Angeles.
Karita has done a lot of research about how generations of African Americans have moved in and out of coal towns like Lynch. She's actually writing a book about it. Here's how Derek describes her.
She does a lot of interviews around here. Everybody knows who she is. One thing that everybody loves about her is her hair. It's like really poofy and curly. Just beautiful. I love it. That's why I'm trying to get my hair like hers, big and natural.
Karita told me she's not surprised that Derek hasn't heard much about how his family first came to Lynch.
Memory is a very complicated thing with the African-American experience. One of my mentors, Tony Bogues, calls slavery a historical catastrophe, a shattering of who you are and where you come from. You don't always want to be remembering that. Their lives, their roots, their origin stories started in Kentucky, and their parents weren't necessarily trying to tell them all their horror stories or what they endured to get there.
Even though it's not something Derek's talked about much, I think that if you want to understand Derek's struggle to stay, you have to understand that many parts of his struggle are forces that his family has been dealing with for generations.
This has been a story of African American struggle and striving that we can trace through American history because we're always getting kicked out or moved from where we settle down.
So now we're going to speed through 100 years of Derek's family history, starting with the origin story.
How the hell did all these black folks get to Harlan County, Kentucky? When the mining industry came into eastern Kentucky, we're at the point of World War and the country needs steel. Coal is one of the products to make steel. So the mining industries found themselves with an insatiable need for labor.
Mining companies like the one that built and owned Lynch sent labor agents far and wide to recruit coal miners. One place where they recruited was Alabama, where Derek's great-granddad came from.
They were in a dire situation in the late 1800s, early 1900s in Alabama, and leaving Alabama was more of an escape.
Slavery had technically been abolished, but many African Americans were still trapped doing forced labor in abusive conditions. Some were stuck in unfair farming contracts, and others were arrested, often on flimsy charges, then sold to industries that needed workers. Many of these leased convicts ended up working in coal mines, where about 1 in 20 workers would die each year. It was dangerous to stay in Alabama, but it was also dangerous to leave. Derek's great-granddad used to tell a story about one scary encounter that happened while he was traveling to Kentucky.
He was unsure if they were going to kill him right there.
Cynthia Harrington remembers how her dad, Derek's great-granddad, used to tell the story.
He used to get drunk, and he basically told us the same story when he got drunk about how he hoboed, we call it hitchhike, from Alabama, because he had heard about the jobs in the mines. He said he was walking and these white men saw him one day and they said, "Hey, nigger, where you going?" So he told them that he was going to Kentucky to get a job. And they said, "We heard that niggers can preach." So they said to him, "Nigger, preach." He said he had to do it because he was a little afraid. And then he said, after he preached, they said, "Well, we heard niggers like to dance." They said, "Nigger, dance." And, you know, once he danced and they taunted him some more, they let him go.
In Lynch, he started a large family, 14 kids, one of whom is Derek's grandma. There was decent paying work for a while, but then the coal industry hit a bump due to some forces that might sound familiar to people watching today's coal downturn. Coal was losing ground to competition from another fossil fuel, and coal miners were being replaced by fancy new mining machines.
When we come to the mid-1940s, as the country is transitioning its dependence from coal to oil, the mining industry began to mechanize heavily. There was not so much of a need for all of that manual labor. As quickly as they pulled these people in, they shut them out. I know in the case of Lynch, the African Americans were the first to be cut out of the labor economy.
Many folks in Lynch moved away.
Harlan County lost 70% of its African American population between the years of 1940 and 1970. That is an extreme outmigration.
Derek's grandma was part of that wave of people who left Lynch. She followed some of her older siblings to New York City. There, she met her husband, Derek's grandpa, who'd come from Trinidad. Then, in the 70s, her husband lost his job, just as the coal industry started to bounce back. Mines in Harlan County were hiring again, and Derek's grandma wanted to get her kids away from the heroin epidemic that had arrived in New York. So, they moved to Lynch.
When drugs started getting bad, came back to raise my kids, and I've been here ever since.
Derek's grandma actually worked in the mines too for a year, around 1979. Partly because she wanted to see what it was like, and partly because her husband had told her not to.
He always tell me, "You ain't going no mine." So I went in there. I worked close to a year on a belt line. And I enjoyed it. It really paid good. But I need to be home. That was my job, be home, my kids.
This boom, like the last one, turned into a bust. And once again, many folks in Lynch moved away. Among them was Derek's mom, Katina Akal.
When the coal mine shut down here, everybody had no choice but to move. I moved off after I graduated high school. I had went to Lexington. I went to University of Kentucky, but I dropped out after I had Derek. The job I was working in was third shift, and I didn't have anybody to watch him. So I brought him here with my mom. So I was basically in Lexington for about 10 years, but I was always back and forth. And then after I had my younger son, I decided to come back home, and best decision I ever made.
Derek's mom, Katina, got a job at a factory. Then she went back to school and managed to get a job close to home that she loves.
I counsel at-risk kids. I felt like this is what I was meant to do.
Derek's mom and grandma both found their way back to Lynch, but they were kind of the exception.
In the neighborhood we live in, it was somebody in every house. Now we live here and then there's three houses empty. There's the next house and there's three houses empty. It's just terrible now.
Derek's cousin, Carita Brown, is from one of those branches of the family that didn't move back. She grew up in New York on Long Island, but her family visited Lynch at least once a year. And Carita thought it was a magical place.
This was a town that was segregated. So, you know, all I knew was that it was this black world. I thought everyone was black, not only in Lynch, but all Appalachia, in my mind, was black.
When out-of-town folks would come to visit, Carita and the rest of the family would often end up gathering at the house that Derek lives in with his grandma and his mom.
Everybody wants to go there and hang out. The best food is going to be there, the biggest laughs. That house, I think, is in one of the most iconic locations for the remnants of the black community in Lynch, because it is
directly across the street from the ballpark, and that park is where everything went down. But what really, I think, makes that house a central location is that it is right behind the Lynch-colored public school. Up until 1963, the schools were racially segregated in Harlan County, and it was the premier Black school. And the building is now owned by the Eastern Kentucky Social Club. So that building has so much symbolic meaning to the Black community, and it's still a gathering place.
Because the social club is so symbolic, it has sometimes become a target. Derek remembers a story his granddad used to tell him about an event that's something of a town legend.
40-something years ago, a group of KKK people was going to try to tear that place down or something like that. My granddad told me how everybody was sitting there ready on their houses, guns out, you know, loaded up, ready for them to show up. And I could just picture my granddad just pointing his gun, just ready for something to happen. But you know what? They never showed up, you know, so I believe that's just some racist people around here, but I don't believe that they're brave enough to show up in Lynch, you know, because Lynch has a history, you know. You know, the people down here don't play around, you know.
In a way, his home's reputation for violence has made Derek feel safer. But the reputation alone hasn't always been enough to keep Derek safe.
It was 2015. I went to a house party. My girlfriend at the time, she walked up a hill. It was away from the party. And I was following right behind her, and there was this guy jogging behind me, just screaming at Emory like crazy. One of them had a knife on him, and like he flicked that knife out. He was just sitting there holding it, just looking at me. My life flashed before my eyes. I was like, well, these guys are gonna probably try to kill me or something, so I'm probably have to fight for my life. And I looked at my girlfriend. My girlfriend was just sitting there just shaking. She didn't know what to do. So I just like, you know, I was just ready to go. The first thing I done, you know, was swung on the dude that had the knife first. Boom, knocked him out, first hit. The other dude, he punched me and I didn't even feel it. Boom, knocked him out. Yeah, so you know, the guy with the knife just kept on going after him, you know, start beating him half to death, you know, going crazy, beating up these two dudes. You know, it looked like I killed him, you know, two bodies on the ground. That's what it looked like. I remember I came home, it was like 7 o'clock in the morning. I had a blue hoodie on and I had blood all over my hoodie, my pants, the white part of my shoes, and all around here was covered in blood. Later on that day, got a phone call, you know, from the cops, and they was like, man, you probably had to go to jail for assault or almost attempted murder because that guy that had that knife apparently had a really bad concussion. I told him the full story. I was like, listen, dude, he had a knife on him, so I'm fighting for my life. You know, he could have stabbed me in my neck or something. You know, I wouldn't be here, you know. I told the cops about that stuff, and then they dropped the charges on me. They asked me if I'm going to press charges on them. I said, you know, I felt bad for, you know, for what I did. The big talk in town was like, oh, man, Derek, but I killed a dude. That was, like, the biggest talk for, like, almost, like, 3 months, you know. And usually I didn't, like, you know, step out the house, you know. You know, if I had to fight, then I have to. But it's just, I was so embarrassed of, like, what I'd done to that man. And I broke his jaw in two different places and fractured his skull with the kick that I gave him. And like, what's crazy about it was, I like, 2 months after that, you know, I went to another house party, and he was up there. And he had scars all over his face. He had one scar on his forehead. And he came up to me, and he was like, man, I'm so sorry for what happened. I was drunk. You really beat me up, and you made me realize I don't need to be doing that. I said, I forgive you. Do you guys forgive me? And he was like, yeah. He was just sitting there talking to me and everything. He tried to hug up on me and everything, you know. And I give him a hug back, you know, just be friendly. Me and those guys were cool now, so everything's cool.
I guess I'm wondering if that experience pushed you more towards wanting to leave at all or, like, made you less comfortable with this area.
I mean, no. I mean, it can happen anywhere. You know, it's just crazy, you know, to sit here and think about, you know, anywhere it can happen. You know, anywhere. I was so friendly with everybody around here, you know. I didn't think it would happen towards me, but it did. It didn't push me to move, but it did push me to start looking somewhere else.
That was Derek Akal, a young African-American in Harlan County, Kentucky. Benny Becker produced that story back in 2017. You can listen to the entire Struggle to Stay series on our website at wvpublic.org. There have been a few developments in Derek's life recently. He currently lives in Lexington, Kentucky. He was working for Cumberland Mine Service, but got laid off during the pandemic. He's hoping to start work in the manufacturing industry soon. Also, his cousin, Carita Brown, who we just heard has been working for several years to document oral histories of Eastern Kentucky, well, she's published a book. It's called Gone Home, Race and Roots Through Appalachia. According to the Appalachian Regional Commission, minorities make up almost 20% of the population throughout Appalachia. African Americans make up about half of that minority group. Back in February, our associate producer Eric Douglas attended a talk by Bill Hairston called Growing Up Black in Appalachia.
I'm what you call a professional storyteller. What that means is that I go a lot of places telling different stories.
That's Hairston speaking at the West Virginia State University Economic Development Center on Charleston's west side in early 2020. Hairston is a big man with a bald head and a graying beard. He has a smile on his face that makes you want to believe his stories, even when he tells you they may not be true. He is a professional storyteller, after all. Today he lives in Charleston, West Virginia, but he was born in Phoenix, Alabama in 1949, a small town that Hairston says was predominantly black.
Dennis was black. My teachers were black. The lawyers were black. The pharmacists were black. Everybody was black. White folks sort of showed up here and there, and they were in town, but they were on another part of town for one thing. And other than the mailman and the potato chip guy that came to the store and the store owner, we really didn't see a lot of white folks on a regular basis.
But at 11 years old, Hairston and his family moved 625 miles north to join his grandfather in the predominantly white town of St. Albans, West Virginia. Hairston says they were the only family of color in the area, and he and his sister immersed themselves by playing with the neighborhood kids.
We had to get used to this whole situation. We got there in June and we spent our whole summer playing, enjoying, having a good time, going down into St. Albans and seeing nothing but white folks.
As summer came to an end, it was time for Hairston and his sister to go to school. And unbeknownst to them, it was a multiracial school, something he says they'd never experienced. And as they were walking to the bus stop,
and we noticed that the little white kids that we played with all summer long were walking with us. And we sort of said to ourselves, well, maybe they use the same bus stop. And we got on the bus and right behind us came these white kids. We said, well, maybe they use the same bus. The bus took off, and when it got to the school, we looked at the name of the school, and sure enough, that's where the white kids were going.
60 years later, Hairston considers himself a West Virginian. He says he's faced racism, and it hasn't always been an easy journey, but a lot of his experiences in the Mountain State are the reason he became a storyteller. After his talk on Charleston's West Side, Hairston sat down with West Virginia Public Broadcasting to share more about his journey to becoming a storyteller.
Goes all the way back to St. Albans. On people really would just sort of sit on their porch and share all kinds of things and share stories. And then in my last 2 years of high school, the west side of Charleston, there was a place right over here, no more than two and a half blocks away, where there was a VFW club, big old oak tree outside. And on Saturday night, the men would gather there, and as a kid, you couldn't say anything, but they just pass the bottle and tell each other some of the biggest stories in the world.
Telling stories allows Hairston to address issues that are difficult or uncomfortable, especially about race. In his talk, Hairston told a story about lifeguards that didn't want to desegregate a pool in 1960s Charleston. They sprayed Hairston and his friends with water hoses to forcibly remove them. But he also told a story about encountering a more subtle form of discrimination at an event more recently. Some things were said that had an implied racial bias. That evening, he used a story from the main stage to point out what had happened and why it needed to change. Hairston says he uses stories, often laced with humor, to help people understand the issues, especially when it comes to race, that surround us.
And I realized that West Virginia, as much as I love it, and I love it to death, there are issues that we don't deal with. There's some things that we need to work on, always. It's still the same message, you know. Love your state, love who you are, but be aware. But I hope that this message keeps conversation alive, keeps people talking, making people aware so that when they hear something among their friends or their fathers or their uncles or whatever, they at least challenge it a little bit. I think we all become better.
Hairston travels the region telling stories about his childhood that, he hopes, give his listeners a better understanding about what it means to grow up black in Appalachia. For Inside Appalachia, I'm Eric Douglas.
Black is the color of my true love's hair. His lips are like some rosy fair. The sweetest face and the neatest hands. I love the ground whereon he stands. Soft is the feel of my true love's skin. And strong the arms he folds me in. The clearest eyes and the truest heart. He lets me stop before I start. Yeah.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. With career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs, to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.
Today on Inside Appalachia, we're exploring how conversations about racial equality impact our black sisters and brothers here in our region. Often their voices are not included when Appalachians are in the national spotlight. That has to change. Several writers created a group in the 1990s called the Appalachian Poets to contribute to that change. We heard from one of the founding members, Frank X. Walker, earlier in our show. Next, we'll hear from another, Crystal Wilkinson. She's originally from Casey County, Kentucky. She lived most of her life on Indian Creek. Back in 2016, our friends at WMMT recorded a conversation with Wilkinson about what inspired her to write.
Well, I think I was probably always a writer. My grandmother always told the story, and it sounds really romantic, one of those classic sort of writer fishing tales, so I'll tell you. But she always says that after she'd read all the books in the house to me, and then later on I was able to read them myself, and after she'd read them all to me and I'd read them all myself, then I started writing my own when I ran out. And I think that was part of it, but you know, the culture there, one, was conducive to solitude because I was an only child. I was my mother's only child, and I was being grandparent raised there on a farm up in that holler. So I think the solitude was one of the things. But I was also sort of born into sort of a classic artistic mountain family. I mean, my grandmother made quilts, and those were the things that were being done in the family. My mother played piano by ear and was a writer as well. So I think it was sort of a natural inclination. And I was also a very imaginative child, and part of that, I think, was bred from the solitude as well.
Wilkinson says she didn't always identify as Appalachian, but as she's grown older, she's come to understand that her identity is both an African-American and as an Appalachian.
You can look at me and see that I'm African-American, but when I start talking and then you get you know, you see the raised eyebrows, and then it's the questions like, you know, do you feel safe there? Well, do you feel safe in your home? Like, it's home, you know, of course I feel safe. And a lot of other questions that come down the pike regarding race.
Wilkinson currently teaches at the University of Kentucky, where she's an associate professor of English in the MFA in Creative Writing program. Over the years, she's taught at other schools, including Berea College, where she met young people who also questioned how they identified themselves.
Appalachia wasn't a word that my grandparents attached to themselves, and wasn't a word that I attached to myself until I got much older. And I find that to be a similar experience with a lot of my students at Berea. They grow up a particular way, and you're just good country people.
Many different cultures are part of Appalachia's story, and Wilkinson finds that people all over the globe have connections with their region.
Because I, you know, as I've traveled all over Appalachia, one of the things that's been like really wonderful is like when I was in Radford, Virginia, I met a woman and she said, well, you know, we were Italian and a lot of people always thought that we were different. My father worked in the coal mines, but we learned a lot about our Italian culture. She says, I guess I'm Appalachian. And I said, yeah, I guess you are. And then I've heard different people that are in the region through their parents, through various professions and things. And so I met a woman who said, well, I must be Asialatian. And I said, yeah, you're Asialatian. Yeah, yes, you are. And a variety of things that happen that way. So anytime that you can come across something that gives you a stronger sense of self-identity, that it's important to have. The name, what we call ourselves, is important. And I think it's grown, you know, when Frank coined the term, he was speaking of a particular experience that he had, and he was speaking of a particular group of people, those, you know, 10 of us that met in the back room of a coffee house and were trying to write and try to figure out who we were and how we fit in with other writers. But I think since then, in the 25 years since he coined that term, it has expanded and given a lot of people, you know, people call the Carolina chocolate drops Appalachian, and musicians that are Appalachian, and other, you know, visual artists that are consider themselves Appalachian. And it's sort of a back straightening, empowering word that has long since gone on beyond his original intention. And I think that's a wonderful thing too.
That was Appalachian poet and Appalachian writer Crystal Wilkinson. She has a new book called Perfect Black, soon to be released from the University of Kentucky Press.
Some black morning, when this life is over,
in our show today, we've heard from several people talking about their experience being black in Appalachia. We want to hear more of these stories. If you're a person of color, tell us what Appalachia is to you. What is your vision for a better, more just Appalachia? We here at West Virginia Public Broadcasting recognize that we need to do a better job listening to you. Your story is our story, too. And like 17-year-old Aiden Satterfield said at the top of the show, maybe if we can help educate and introduce each other to the diversity of our experiences here and across our planet, then maybe we can start to break down the walls that block the view. Because the view here inside Appalachia is something beautiful and colorful. And until young people of color like Aiden can move freely without worrying about being treated unfairly, and until black men and women don't have to worry they may be killed at the hands of police, we all have a lot of work to do. You can find us on Twitter at InAppalachia. You can also send us an email to InsideAppalachia@WVPublic.org. Visit WVPublic.org/InsideAppalachia to sign up for the Inside Appalachia newsletter, too.
Hi. just a few more weary days and then I'll fly away to that land where joy shall never end. I'll fly away, for someday I'll fly away.
Till next time, thanks for joining me as we journey throughout Appalachia. Our theme music is by Matt Jackford. Other music this week was provided by Ethel Caffey Austin, Bob Thompson, and Rhiannon Giddens, as heard on Mountain Stage. Roxy Todd is our producer. Eric Douglas is our associate producer. Our executive producer is Glennis Board. She also edited our show this week. Our audio mixer is Patrick Stevens. Xander Alloy also helped produce this show. Listen to this show again at wvpublic.org/InsideAppalachia. There you can also subscribe to the podcast or download all of our stories or look for the Inside Appalachia podcast wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Jessica Lilly. Inside Appalachia is a production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. With career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.
Nobody knows the trouble I see. Nobody knows my sorrow. Nobody knows the trouble I see. Glory, hallelujah. Nobody knows the trouble I see. Nobody knows my sorrow. Nobody knows the trouble I see. Glory, hallelujah. Swing low, sweet chariot. Coming for to carry me home. Swing low, sweet chariot. Coming for to carry me. Thank you. I looked over Jordan, and what did I see? Coming for to carry me me, coming for to carry me home. Tis the old ship of Zion, tis the old ship of Zion. Tis the ship of Zion. Get on board. Get on board. It has landed many a thousand. It has landed many a thousand. It has landed many a thousand. You better get on board. Get on board. I've been in the storm so long. Been in the storm so long, chillin'. I've been in the storm so long. Lord, give me some time to pray. Let me tell you about my mother. Tell you how she came along. She asked God for a blessing, and he gave her. Storm so long, children. Been in the storm so long. God, give me some time to pray. Oh, freedom. Oh, freedom. Oh, freedom over me. And before I'd be a slave, I'd be sleeping in my grave, and go home with my Lord to be free. No more mourning, no more. No more.